by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you will be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it is time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker tonight is Roy A. Not unmuted yet, Roy.
Here we go. Hi, everybody. My name is Roy M. and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, guys. Welcome to the world. Jeez. So, well, by the grace of God and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since April 17th, 1986, a class of 87. Yeah. And my sponsor is Tom B. And I want to shout out to all my Bouchard brothers out there. And my home group is the Pacific Group. And when I got the call, I just thought to myself, I left a message on Marty. I called Marty back and I said, this let me know what you want me to read. And he goes, no, you're doing 10 minutes. And I'm really grateful. It made me really think about my sobriety. I've been sober for long time. I barely sponsor anybody that has more time than my sobriety now. And that's when you know you're getting old. I just wanted to, I've traveled around the world and it's really interesting. A lot of the times where they ask you to stand up, identify yourself, where you're from, and give us your home group. And I tell them I'm from the Pacific group. They will say, I get a lot of negative reactions, which is kind of interesting because most people have never been in the Pacific group. And I have to identify with that because when I was new, I got sober in the Marina Santa West LA area. And they were telling me, they go like, dude, if you cannot stay sober, we're going to have to send you to the Pacific group and you're going to have to go pick up poop. And just, it was like, wow. The truth be told, I heard about watches when people, they have a party right before their first year of sobriety, and they all went out to Norm's back in those days. We went to Norm's in Santa Monica, and we would play softball at the yard every Saturday. Well, we did. So I eventually came to the Pacific group. Long story short is, I just want to say, newcomers, please, if you don't hear anything, just don't drink tonight. And I don't know time zone you're in, but here in Pacific Standard Time, it's about 4.5 hours. And I could do that. When they told me, they said, just don't drink today. Just don't drink till midnight. And I could do that. Make no doubt about it. I am a professional alcoholic. I worked in a gourmet market. Of course, I would stock the beers. We had 184 different imported beers. I was in charge of the wine section. The people, they would give me the free sample, and I would just make all these wine recommendations. And for a little while there, I thought I would be, I thought that was going to be my career because I was really good at it. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a gourmet. I would open a bottle of Cabernet in the morning, and then we'd have cook filet, and just it was a different time. But I just. When I was getting sober, when I had the thought of getting sober, I couldn't imagine it. I didn't really want to do it either. And people say it's an addiction, it's a disease or whatever, or it's a habit. But I tell you one thing, if I'm going to be a slave to habit, someone told me to be a slave to good habits. And that was not in my letters. I went to Japan, and that's a whole long story, but I came back and I went to Japan for 3 years. I came back to my regular meetings, and everybody was gone. I was secretary of Monday Night Men's Stag in Brentwood. 3 years later, I came back. People were welcoming me to the meeting, probably about 60 people there. Maybe there was only 5 or 10 people that were still there after 3 years. And I thought, wow, that was a trip. But was everywhere. Tuesday night, 2+2 in Westwood. Only exception was a Thursday night in Brentwood, but it was still a whole changing of the guards. It scared me. And that time I was working downtown, and we had these noon meetings. Thank God for that, because you just don't know what happens between 9 and noon. I would just come in those meetings crazy and sit down my lunch, and it was a different format every day, and it was exactly what I needed. And the Pacific Group, most of the secretaries were people from the Pacific Group. I met Doretha there, and she gave this great talk, and I said, thanks for coming out. And she said, she came from Mongolia. She took the day off to come speak at our meeting, and she goes, that's what we do. And I'm like, that's not what I do. But anyway, long story short, I became secretary of the meeting, and people were saying, come to the Pacific Group and troll for some meetings. And first person that greeted me, somebody introduced me to Jim Shaw. It was a guy named Art Lewis, and Art Lewis introduced me to Jim Shaw. And Jim took me by the arm. He's got your calendar. He says, he introduced me to all these great people. And I'm just here to say that, man, there's the Pacific Group, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. I wanted to show a couple of things. This is a file, and these are files of all the poochies that I've ever, these are all the meetings that I've been to. And it's crazy. They said, read the pooch sheet and start doing, going to parties or watches and other things. And I did that. I've been at the convention. And I would just say, if it wasn't for the Pacific Group, they did this savings plan where you would save $5 a meeting, and then in 3 years, you'd have enough money to go to the convention. And I, as a result, this year would have been my 6th convention. I'm sorry, but it didn't go down. And I salute Steve and his whole team for just helping us out and giving us our refunds and so on and so forth. But some people look at the meeting here, and I look at all you people. I know a lot of people here, and some people are saying, how do you guys all know each other? And it's because it's a commitment. And Wednesday night, typically at 5:30, I would get to the meeting so I could park. Shout out to the parking crew. Can you imagine making, and then coffee crew making coffee for nearly 1,000 people? It's just crazy. And then, we don't park in the neighbors ask us not to park in their on the streets. It's amazing how this huge group has such a commitment to honor Alcoholics Anonymous and respect the traditions and the principles. And I just got on board. I will say, like I said, I'm not an original. I wasn't born and raised in a Pacific Group. I never had a watch or anything like that. But I will tell you, I latched on. I became a part of it. We have so many activities. I'm part of campers, and there's so many different activities. Whatever you want to do, you can invite it here. So I would just say, please, when we get back to the meeting, even not, just come and join us. And there's that line at the end of Spiritual Experience where it says contempt prior to investigation. Well, that talks about AA, but also a lot of people could use that when it comes to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I forgot to show you. We have a banquet every year. I take pictures. This is our class of 80. So all the people that got sober in 1986, we have a banquet every year. And Joe S. Talked and Sharon, love you, Sharon. Georgia, okay. People talk about Clancy and they don't even really know about him, but Clancy used to speak at every class banquet. And so he would fly around the world, speak somewhere, and then he'd come back on Sunday. Thank you. And he would get from the airport to a class. And it was just every year there would be another class banquet. So he would, I don't know. Anyway, I will just end with this. In the words of, Herbert Spencer, also he said, education is for action. So we say something like knowledge is good, but action is key. So take that contrary action, please. I'll put my number in the chat. Please give me a call. Famous words of Tommy Dunning, don't get too well too quickly. And my former loving sponsor up in heaven, Guy Paul. This is the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you have this. When the music of life begins to play, Alcoholics Anonymous will teach you how to dance. Before my life, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Roy. Our second 10-minute speaker tonight is Gola R.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gola. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gola.
This is terrifying. And I have to look right at my face, too, which I hate. I was asked to do this about 10 minutes ago. I am a plan B for tonight. I'm totally used to being second choice, but due to Alcoholics Anonymous, it won't go in my nightly inventory anymore. I am sweating and somehow also sweating and shivering and super, super nervous because it is so important to me to tell you not only what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me in my life, but also this group. I'm so full of emotion and I get it from my sponsor. So if I just start crying at any point, it's 100% because I'm grateful. It's not because I'm upset about this in any way. And if you get anything from my talk tonight, if you just completely tune out the rest of the time, I just want to give you a quick idea of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. What it was like was that as far back as I can remember, I was just a kid that was weird and felt like an alien and was crawling out of my skin and was full of fear and anxiety, always. I started wanting to die and having suicidal ideation at age 10. And the only thing that brought me peace or relief in any way was taking that drink. And I chased that first drunk until what happened was that my life, you know, I traded everything I was passionate about, everything that I loved in my life, all the people that I was close to, for an opportunity to continue drinking. And because of where it took me in my life, that drink no longer gave me relief. And I asked a God that I didn't believe in for grace that I didn't deserve at that time. And it was given to me and I was brought to you people. And through a series of working the steps and working with a sponsor and getting deep into this program, what my life is like today is big and beautiful and full of peace and a life truly beyond my wildest dreams. Not because it's perfect. It's certainly not. Not because I have everything that I want, but because I've been given everything that I need. My sobriety date is December 29th, 2018. And I knew my first Pacific group meeting was Wednesday night. And my experience was not, I did not come in here. I was not scared of you. I loved you. I was in love with you from the minute I saw you. You were shiny and bright and attractive. And I wanted what you had because you were happy without drinking. And that just seemed foreign to me. Like the idea of joy and peace. I did not know those ideas. And that was not my experience the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was April of 2018. I did not identify as an alcoholic. I was brought here by my higher power. It just so happened that my higher power at that point in my life was a nice Jewish boy from the Palisades. I did not identify as an alcoholic. I saw all the differences. I saw no similarities. I hadn't lost a job. I hadn't gotten a DUI. I hadn't lost a relationship. I hadn't had any severe consequences as a result of my drinking. I just knew that I was miserable. And I figured that, you know, that God thing really scared me. It scared me to death. I didn't understand. I never believed in God. I had no concept of a higher power. My dad proclaimed to me pretty early on in life that God is dead, a la Nietzsche. And that was kind of, I would be the first person to tell you that. And so being uninterested in holding your hand and singing Kumbaya, I decided to go it on my own because it had been going so well for me at that point in my life, being a lone wolf. And so, you know, in those next 8 months, I tried everything I could possibly do to fix myself. And I am a seeker. Like I'm always looking for, you know, what is wrong with me and what's the cure and whether that's going to a psychiatrist, meditating, doing a geographic. I love those. Having a relationship with someone who didn't support my drinking, having a relationship with someone who did support my drinking, like all the different things. I tried all of them in those 8 months. And I just want to tell you that that week after I left Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, I did lose my job. I did lose my apartment. I did lose my relationship. And I tried to kill myself for the first time. And, you know, then there was a geographic and a different relationship. And, you know, I hadn't been drinking every day the first time that I'd come here. Drugs are a part of my story, and they were a big part of my story the first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I started drinking daily. And, you know, by the time I made it to you, I was not a vision for you. I was living in between my car and friends' couches. I had 48 cents in my bank account. I weighed 93 pounds. I had a shaved head. I had completely alienated everybody in my life that I cared about or that remotely cared about me. My mom did not know where I was for 2 months. Thank you. And my dad was really worried about me as well. What happened is that I went to a bar one night trying to get someone to buy me a drink, and it happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he ended up being the same person who 12-stepped me on Christmas Day, 2018. And one thing that he said that always has really stuck with me my entire sobriety, and I think it's the foundation of what we do for each other here. I was so scared of everything, you know, like I said, I've always been so full of fear. Like, I was scared of myself. I was scared of you. I was scared of what you thought of me. I was scared of what I thought of me. I was scared of living. I was scared of dying. And the only thing that took that away was drinking, and I trusted no one. And I asked him, why are you doing this? And he said, because helping you is part of my recovery. And I thought that was so beautiful. Did I get sober then? No. I waited 3 days. And on my very last day out there, I asked God for help. And doors just started opening up for me. And one of those doors was I couldn't afford treatment at the time. I didn't have insurance. And it just so happened that my dad's friend, they took him to rehab when I was 4 months old in the car. And he owned a treatment center and he took me in for free. And it took me a week to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I walked into that meeting in the Valley, I was so excited because I thought I wouldn't know anybody. And there was a girl there that I'd known since I was 5 years old. And she had been sober since the last time I saw her in high school. And I knew she was a sick one. So if it worked for her, it would probably work for me. And I followed her to another meeting where I met my sponsor, Georgia. And I asked her to sponsor me. And I walked up to her like a basket case. And she said that she'd work with me. And, you know, it was easy for me to see those coincidences in my life and those God shots in my life as something that was intervening and pushing me down a path. And, you know, I was a basket case. I was a feral cat. I was a junkyard dog. I was unsocialized. I had no idea how to talk to you. And I was fearful of you for the longest time. But I thought, hey, you know, to be quite honest with you, like, I didn't come here to get sober. I went to treatment so I'd have like a safe place to sleep. I went to AA because I'd gotten tired of treatment and I wanted a night out. I got a sponsor because I wanted my car back. And it's just been this like journey of like having a little bit of willingness and all of a sudden opening the door a little bit for God to come in and God just rushing through with all this light. And, part of that was working with Georgia and, you know, I was still in self-will early in sobriety and I made a pretty big mistake. And I remember having to come to Georgia and tell her about it. And, she just looked at me and she's like, okay. I was like, really shocked. And she's like, did you think I was going to be mad at you? And I said, no. Well, I said, yes. And she said, no, that's not what this is about. And, you know, I just felt so much unconditional love in that moment. And it's the unconditional love that I've found in this program where like the things that I was most ashamed of, the things that I thought would make you hate me and you be disgusted in me have become my greatest assets to help another alcoholic. And I was so hungry for relief that I got deep into my steps quick. I started going to 7 meetings a week. I took a commitment at every single meeting. I started doing my steps with Georgia. I called Georgia every single day. I called her multiple times a day because I was so scared of where I had been at the end of my drinking and who I had been at the end of my drinking that I just wanted to push down everything I was feeling and get relief. And I was kind of crazy. I was really scared of you guys, but I just started doing the deal and I loved it. And, you know, Mount High was a big turning point for me because it made me feel comfortable getting closer to people. And, you know, my roommate who I live with now came up to me at my second PG meeting. And she, when I raised my hand as a newcomer and introduced herself, and she's been my best friend ever since. And we live together today, which is crazy. But my first year went on. I had my watch, which was the most beautiful moment of my entire life because I was surrounded by all of you that I'd come to love so much. And I felt that you loved me too. Thank you. I have 1 minute, right? And my parents were there and they got to see me in this new family that I have in all of you. And they were so supportive of it. And, you know, my family has come around to the idea of me being in this program, and they're super supportive of it, and they're super proud of who I am today. And I've been making living amends to them since basically the minute I got sober, and it's made this entire process a lot easier. If you're new and you're here tonight, I want you to know that I never wanted this. I couldn't ever imagine my life without alcohol or drugs. And now the way that I look at it is that I would gladly give you back this last 7 years of my drinking and drug use to have more of this journey. And I'm just excited to be doing this one day at a time with all the people that I get to walk this path with. This is truly like the best deal in town. I could not be more grateful for the people in my life, for my sponsor, for my friends, and most of all for my connection with God, who I used to just talk to in early sobriety as if it was someone at the ceiling. And then day by day, it's grown this connection that is the most valuable thing in my entire life. It is such an honor to speak at this meeting. You guys are everything to me. I want to thank you all for this opportunity. And if you're new, please keep coming back. I'll put my number in the chat at the end of the meeting. I would love to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Gola. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group conscience. And our main speaker tonight is Arisa B.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Arisa, and I'm most definitely an alcoholic. Sorry, I was trying to check and see if I was muted or not. The date of my last drink was October the 13th, 1993, and for that I am truly, truly grateful. And it's only possible because of 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts, a relationship with a higher power that I never wanted, and unbelievable sponsorship through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And couple of my stats. I just told you my sobriety date. My home group is the Beacon Group, which is in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is basically Boston. My sponsor is Mary M. from the Pacific Group. And she knows that she's my sponsor. She's here this evening, and it's an honor and a privilege to get to be with you tonight. PG has been part of my sobriety story since the beginning. And I just want to start off with that I owe a huge debt of gratitude to this meeting, to Clancy, and to a lot of those of you who have helped me along the line over the years, and you know who you are. I wouldn't be the woman that I am without the love and support of this particular group. It's been quite a number of years since I've been with you. The last time I was here, Millie did a 10-minute talk when I did my pitch, and I know that we lost her not too long ago, and I wanted to remember her. Marty, thank you for asking me to speak, truly. And Georgia, thank you for getting me in line. Gola, you did an amazing job getting us all organized tonight, and then on top of it, an incredible 10-minute pitch. Roy, thank you. You know, this is the sort of meeting that takes many, many hands, and the legacy of service here is something that is unprecedented anywhere else, and it's what I love about Pacific Group. You taught me what it means to be a woman of service. So that, of course, was not how it started off. I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. I am the adult child of the adult child of an alcoholic and the adult child of a missionary. My father's from Brazil, and my mother's from the East Coast. So it was not a normal childhood by any means whatsoever. And I did not get to Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, it just sounded like a good idea. I very much identify with the other two speakers. Like, this is not what anybody, I think, wakes up and says, I can't wait to go to AA, you know? No. The way I grew up, it was like, I just never had skin. I don't know. I was born differently, it seems. You know, long line of alcoholism in my family. My maternal grandfather died with almost 40 years of sobriety. He was one of the early AAs in Texas. And, but he didn't get sober until after my mom was out of the house. So when I started drinking, my first real drunk was at the age of 15. My parents gave me a little bit of alcohol here and there, you know, along the way. I didn't know that everybody didn't have alcohol growing up. It wasn't a warm, cozy family. There was a lot of abuse. Dad was a real rageaholic. Mom was emotionally absent at best. And I remember being in fourth grade thinking, you know, that we were not like other people and that someday I was going to have to fix it. Now, there's no ego involved there, right? But that's just kind of where I was. It was just, I was one big, you know, ingrown hair, and everything bothered me. I didn't know how to get along with people. I lived in this kind of closed off little world, and, you know, I didn't get along with my siblings. I had a lot of physical problems, and they would leave me behind. And so most of my life, I didn't sleep. I had, like I said, health problems. And my parents just said, here's a bag of clay, you know, like, leave us alone. And so I did. And what changed when I found alcohol, that first drunk, that first night I went out, I was with a girlfriend. She was a senior. I was a sophomore. And we had half a daiquiri, frozen daiquiri. It had one nip in it, big old, you know, blender full of sticky frozen stuff. And we sat out on a pier watching the sun go down over the Gulf of Mexico. And it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And I had this incredible sense of just, life was okay. Life was just, for the first time in a very, very long time, if ever, okay. I didn't know what that felt like. I like to think about it kind of like there was just never enough oxygen in the air. And that drink, it seemed to just, like, somebody tiptoed up behind me and pulled off the bag over my head that I'd been somewhat asphyxiated my whole life. And I didn't know that. Somehow it just felt like I had the answers that had been just outside of my reach. Of course, you know, I'm not the kind of alcoholic that, you know, some of you guys are, which means, you know, one of my first resentments in AA was people would talk about the first 5 or 10 years and they were really great. And then there were the, you know, 5 or 10 years that were a little dysfunctional, and then it got bad. So my first night drinking, I ended up with a minor in possession. We're come walking off the pier and, you know, there's styrofoam cups and we're good girls. We don't litter. And I got a minor in possession for possessing no alcohol whatsoever. And that was just the way my drinking went. I seemed to be the magnet for trouble. So I looked at her and I said, you know, if I'm going to be in this much trouble, I'm going to deserve it. And I convinced her to take me back to her grandparents' house where I found a screwdriver and I took the hinges off of the liquor cabinet and proceeded to have a drink out of every single bottle in that cabinet. And it was big. Needless to say, I was locked in the den because they needed to contain me. And that was kind of how everybody had to deal with me. I needed containment. I think I would have probably gotten in a lot more trouble if the people who cared about me hadn't decided that they needed, you know, to limit the collateral damage when they saw me coming. But anyway, what happened was, you know, I broke things. Everybody was mad at me. I blacked out, you know, vomited violently. I had, you know, the shakes the next day. And that was my first night drinking, and I couldn't wait to do it again. That's not normal. So I can't tell you why that is. You know, most people, that doesn't happen on the first night out. And I just didn't know that everybody didn't do that. I didn't know that everybody didn't black out. I didn't know that everybody didn't throw up all the time. I didn't know that everybody, I just thought I was thirsty. That's all. I just thought I was thirsty. I mean, why would anybody not keep drinking? Because my way of seeing the world is, if one is good, if one is making me feel this good, how much better can I feel if I keep going? So, you know, I've never once consciously chosen to stop. You know, I don't understand why anybody keeps the lid for a bottle of liquor. Like, why? Like, my idea of one is until it's gone. My favorite drink is, what do you have? You know, I was a minor. I did 99% of my drinking as a minor. And so really what that looked like was when I could, how much I could, as fast as I could. Within 6 months of me having that first drink, I was in Austin on 6th Street, dancing in bars where it was illegal for me to even be on the premises. That's how quickly my drinking escalated. And I know that's not true for everybody. And it doesn't make me, you know, more or less an alcoholic than those who took longer to get there. What I know today is that what makes me alcoholic is that when I drink, something different happens to me that doesn't happen to other people. I'm married to a non-alcoholic, and bless his heart, you know, when he drinks, he gets a slightly tipsy, out of control feeling, which he does not like. So he stops. He stops. See, for me, sober feels out of control. When I drink, I don't get that feeling. When I drink, I get in control. When I drink, I can finally handle it. Those 9-step promises that we read at so many meetings, I get those through alcohol. What I didn't understand was that alcohol treats alcoholism. It really does. It doesn't do a great job into perpetuity. You know, it's that boomerang that comes back and cuts me to ribbons later. But I couldn't understand why anybody would ever want to be sober, because for me, sober was the worst thing I'd ever experienced in my life. Sober hurt. I was just one big nerve ending. I had been beaten up my entire life, you know, dragged down the stairs, you know, locked in closets, clothes ripped off, you know, like I said, abducted, raped, you name it. I don't even know if I said that. So out of that bar that first night, you know, 6 months after I started drinking, I was abducted and raped. And, you know, all I knew, it never crossed my mind that alcohol had anything to do with that. What crossed my mind was that alcohol was the only way I could cope with that. When I got home from that horrible experience, I started drinking with fury. It was the only thing I knew how to do to keep the panic pushed down, to keep the guilt, the shame, the remorse, the fear, the everything like that just pushed down. I wanted to die. Bill Wilson, you know, in the big book, he talks about drinking for the sickest of all reasons, oblivion, right? And he also talks about, you know, when the stock market crashes, that, you know, he looks at everybody else, you know, men jumping from the towers of high finance, and that disgusted him. He went back to the bar. What I did was I was praying for God to just let me die every night. Let me die. I just couldn't take the pain anymore. And what would happen when I got my driver's license not long after that, and I would sit in my 1976 Cadillac at this T-junction overlooking the Gulf of Mexico, and I would just be trying to gather my courage so that I could drive off the edge because I couldn't take another day. There are a lot of things in AA that we say that I don't really agree with. They're not necessarily, it's not AA. It's just stuff that people brought in. And one of them is God will never give you more than you can handle. Maybe that works for you. It doesn't work for me. I'm the girl who can't handle breathing in and out for 24 hours. That's why I'm here. That's why I drank so much. That's why I always wanted to be drinking, because living hurts. Because living hurts. I don't have a drinking problem. That's why I didn't want to come to you guys, because Alcoholics Anonymous, that's for people who have drinking problems, right? I didn't have a drinking problem. I have a sobriety problem. I hate being sober. Sober is the worst state of mind I can possibly come up with. So I didn't want to come to you. You know, when people started talking to me about, like, maybe you ought to take a look at your drinking. Maybe you should slow down. Maybe you shouldn't be drinking anymore. I'm thinking, maybe I need new friends. Maybe I need to get out of here. You don't know what you're talking about. If what had happened to me had happened to you, you would drink too. That's what I'm thinking. I don't know how to cope. You know, when you guys talked about, you know, being powerless over alcohol and your life becoming unmanageable, like, I got that being powerless over alcohol. I understood intellectually that I didn't drink like other people. None of the other girls are drinking with the football players. None of the other girls are drinking the whole bottle of Jack by themselves in half an hour. None of the other girls are picking invisible things off them 3 days later. You know, that's not happening to all of my girlfriends. That's not normal drinking. I am aware of that. I am also very aware that I don't know what's going to happen once I start. It's Russian roulette, and there's no question in my mind. Once I start drinking, all bets are off. Nobody knows what's going to happen next. I might jump out of a car. I might, you know, fall asleep. Who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? And who knows how much I'm going to drink? You know, I'm not going to stop drinking until it's gone, or you take it away from me, you lock me up, which is why, like I said, from the first night, contain her, just contain her. Right? But what I found is that when you talked about life being unmanageable, that's where I couldn't get on board. I couldn't get on board at first, because if what had happened to me had happened to you, when I got to you guys the first time, my life, I thought I was doing a great job of managing it. You know, I went to AA the week after I came to AA the week after I graduated from high school. And I graduated from high school at the top of my class. I was voted most likely to succeed. I was going to an incredibly great college. I was, you know, class favorite. I was this, I was that, I was whatever, you know, and I really thought, you know, I'm managing just fine considering everything. Yes, I have this drinking problem, but you know, and I couldn't understand how anybody would want to live without alcohol, because it was just too painful. I could do it for a while. And I did for 3.5 years. I would have been a chronic relapser, except I didn't stay in AA. I went to college and I had my big book, which is still up there on the shelf. And, you know, I kept it backwards on the shelf at college because something told me I might need it later. Right. And I just tried to start controlling my drinking. I you know, loved the way Gola was talking about. I love geographics. I really thought that if I left, if I was away from my father, if I was away from all these abusive people, if I was away from my mother, if I was away from my siblings, then I wouldn't need to drink. That drinking was my coping mechanism, and it was. So why would I need to drink, right? And what I started to realize is that I hate you when I'm not drinking. If you can drink, I really, really hate you. But I did everything I could to treat this stuff in my head. I have the chatter of 1,000 monkeys in my head, and they're driving me insane. And they start from the moment I wake up until I go to sleep every single night. And mind you, they're still like puppets in my head making nightmares. I can't get away from them. I can't get away. I had nightmares every single night for the first couple of years of sobriety. I really did. And true, I had a lot of trauma, but you know, I had no understanding that it had anything to do with alcoholism. I started going to therapy. I took antidepressants. I took all the religion classes I could. I did yoga. I learned to put my legs behind my head. I chanted with the Hare Krishnas. I went down to Brazil. I paddled up the Amazon. I swam with piranhas. Like, you name it. I got this. I need to find God. I don't know where he is, but I'm going to look for him, right? I'm willing to do that work. But I wasn't willing to be an alcoholic. I was willing to, you know, put the plug in the jug for a little while. I can do 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. But you know what it is? It's just me holding my breath. That's all it is. And I never, never got that sense of ease and comfort that I get at once by having a few drinks. Never. Not sober. Nothing filled that void. Nothing filled that void. It didn't matter how many awards I won. It didn't matter. None of that stuff mattered. It didn't matter, you know, going to France, going to anywhere. Nothing made it better. The only thing that ever made it better was drinking. So when I got to you, finally, I got to you not because I thought it was a good idea, but because I was out of good ideas. I just told you what all my good ideas are. You know, all the things that I thought were wrong with me, you know, I tried, you know, therapy, good idea. Brazil, good idea. You know, yoga, good idea. But they don't treat alcoholism. I didn't know I had alcoholism. I thought I was too young to have alcoholism. You know, but my last drunk, I was 21, and I hadn't had the DTs for a couple of years. And my idea of normal social drinking is you don't have invisible things crawling on you 3 days later, you know. But that was the kind of drinking I did in high school, and I had been controlling it. Now, I can control it for a while, or at least I used to be able to, but I couldn't control and enjoy it. If I'm going to enjoy it, I'm going to drink everything you have. That's all there is to it, right? So when I got back to you guys, when I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I walked into this meeting, and I like to very lovingly say it was a fundamental meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the woman who was like the queen of AA in Corpus Christi, her name was Marianne White. She was good friends with Clancy. And, you know, that was where I first got to know you guys. And that woman terrified me, and I would eavesdrop on her. And I walked into a meeting, and we didn't have poop patrol, but what we did have, I got washing ashtrays. All the meetings were smoking. I was on ashtray washing duty from the day I walked in, and I was like, but I don't smoke. And they're like, that's why it's called service. you know, and I got to tell you, if you haven't had a job in Alcoholics Anonymous that you hate, ask for one. Please ask for one. You have no idea how helpful it is to have a job that you do not want to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I walked in, they were so happy to see me. And I got to tell you, I am so happy to know that there are newcomers on this call. You know, I want to really take a moment and say, you know, amazing. Like Kim's calling in from a hospital bed. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here, Kim. You know, Holly let us know that she's new. Welcome. You know, it is so important that you raise your hand and let us know you're here, right? We are thrilled you are here. Absolutely over the moon, thrilled you're here. We are so happy that you're here. We really don't care if you're happy you're here or not. And we know you're not happy about it. So just, you know, come on with us. This is the sort of place where, you know, we just put our arms around you and you know, they told me, listen, honey, you don't have to like it. We give you full permission not to like it. Just do it anyway. Just do it anyway. You know, go out into the parking lot, have a temper tantrum, then just do it anyway. They assigned me a sponsor. That woman had 2 months of sobriety. 2 months of sobriety. She was a terrible chronic relapser and she needed to stay sober. And she's trying to do her amends, trying to learn how to pray and meditate, trying to learn all of this stuff. And, you know, she's going to die. And they know, like, she's probably not going to make it. So she needs a newcomer. And they gave her me. I didn't get a choice. They're like, she's going to be your sponsor. I'm like, okay. And you know what? She didn't know what she was doing. She really, I tease all the time. I think she was only a couple pages ahead of me on the big book. But you know what? What she told me was, if I think you're going to drink again if you don't do these steps. And I didn't want to drink again. I had been in this purgatory for 3.5 years of trying not to drink, controlling, trying to solve this thing my way. Best 3.5 years of my life, to be honest. Most painful, horrible, best investment of my life. You know, if you've been a chronic relapser, you know, what I can tell you is I'm glad, because if you got that experience like I got, it is so important that I had that bottom. You know, I almost drowned once when I was a kid. And what I learned about drowning is that if you can't grab onto anything, your only hope is to go down to the bottom, to reach bottom. And then you can push back up to the air. And that bottom is what propels us, gives us the strength and the courage to do what we need to do to stay sober, to work these steps, to walk through the discomfort. You know, we are people who never want to be uncomfortable. But we don't get sober until we are willing to be uncomfortable. That's what I learned. They made sure that they gave me plenty of opportunities to be uncomfortable and to do it anyway. They told me that when your sponsor says jump, you don't ask why, you say exactly how high would you like me to jump, right? My sponsor told me other things like, if you weren't there from prayer to prayer, it's my opinion you were not there. So get there early and stay late and get a job at every meeting you go to. So, you know, that's what I did. I didn't know that service was an option. I didn't know that there weren't, you know, everybody I knew, they were three legacy people, you know, unity, service, and recovery. That is what we do here. You get a service position in the group. You do, you know, whatever you can. And if you can't find anything else to do, go pick up garbage. Make sure that every day you have added something to the world. That's what they taught me, you know. And when I got through this inventory, looking at this stuff that I thought was unforgivable. Like, how do you get, see, I grew up in church and this God that I wanted to believe in, like I just, as I saw it, had let me down. I believed in these things like turn the other cheek, right? And forgiveness and stuff. But I never understood from church, like, how do you do that? How do you forgive? Like Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I love about it is that we tell you how it works. We tell you exactly and specifically how to do these things, right? So when I'm writing this inventory on my dad or on the man who abducted me or whatever it is, you know, I'm trying to give my sponsor what I think I did to deserve this stuff, right? My part, which means I'm not really forgiving him anyway, right? It's not my part. It's resolutely look for my own mistake, disregarding the other person entirely. How do you do that when they abducted you? How do you disregard the other person entirely? And what she told me were things like this. That wasn't your fault. That wasn't your fault. You know, there's nothing that a child could do to deserve the stuff that my dad did to me. Nothing, absolutely nothing. My question is, what are you using it for today? How are you using it as your trump card? How are you using it as your get out of jail free card? How are you using it to rationalize why? How are you using it to beat up all the other men in your life? Why you shouldn't need to trust people? How are you using it to beat yourself up? And see, I had like a video in my head that I would replay and replay and replay. They did it to me once. I've done it to me 42 million times since then. You know, self-harm wasn't really a term that we had, but I was punching myself. I was starving myself. I was getting in relationships with abusive people. You know, I went to Brazil without, for 3.5 months, and I didn't even have, you know, I had no idea where I was going to stay the night I was going. My mother made me have a hotel reservation for the first night, you know. And you guys taught me that I had to start treating myself with love and respect, that I needed to, that you would show me what that looked like. And that's what sponsorship did for me. My sponsors set the bar higher and higher and higher, and not so that I would trip and fall, but because they needed me to understand that I was better than I thought I was, that I could do more than I thought I could do, that they expected more of me, and that often I will fall. If life is easy all of the time, then, you know, I probably wasn't really reaching for what God was trying to send me to, right? And my sobriety has been an incredible, incredible journey, like so much better than I ever would have imagined. You know, I grew up a poor little girl, you know, with a streetwalkers on the corner, you know, and insanity all around. My mother never thought I would go to college, and I've got a master's degree. You know, I graduated from college with the only people who really were there were Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I got to move across the country, go to New York, get a degree, you know, and a master's of fine arts. I'm an artist, you know, to living my dreams, which is where I met my husband, right? I never thought anybody would want to marry me. Why? Because I didn't feel lovable. I didn't have a warm and fuzzy family. You know, I wasn't treated well by life. I never wanted kids because I couldn't imagine that I could give anything to them. This world is a horrible place is what I thought, you know? And I remember being about 2 years sober and realizing that I had something to give, that I'd learned to love because you guys taught me how to love. And what you told me is that, listen, you don't feel loved, not because the world doesn't love you, but because you aren't loving the world. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. It's a program where we get busy helping other people so we get out of God's way. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I start loving you and forget about whether or not you love me, all of a sudden that melts the polar ice cap around my heart. And I start to feel the sunlight of the Spirit. I step out of the shadows. You know, being in grace means I have to do certain things to put me in grace. You know, I thought that when I read those steps off the wall, you know, I really thought that making amends was about groveling. It was about saying that it was okay that you abused me. And it wasn't. That's not what it was. That when I went and I made my amends, it was about going back and picking up the pieces of my soul that I left behind. Every time I compromised my principles, I lost a piece of me. And that's why I hated myself. I really hated myself when I got to you. And you showed me how to build the woman that God intended me to be, to give with no strings attached. So that when I got, you know, when I got to move to New York, I found opportunities to be of service, even though I knew nobody there. I knew nobody there. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. You know, I went there. My sister was living there at the time. And just before I moved, I'd been in a relationship with a man who lived in New York. And I thought we were going to get married. I mean, this God thing was finally working, you know, like there's the boy. You never notice how that's, we think God loves us when we're getting what we want. Right. And, but it all blew up in my face just before I moved. And my sister and that man started dating. And when I got there, they didn't want anything to do with me. So it was worse than not knowing anybody. There were people who would have nothing to do with me there, but I did have AA. I did have AA, you know, and I just started looking for meetings. And one of the first, my first home group in AA, I got the meeting list book and I looked for a meeting in my neighborhood. And there was one on my street that night. And I went down to the street and I'm looking up and okay, where's, you know, it's my building. it's my building. And I go out, I go inside, I ask the receptionist, I'm like, is there an AA meeting here tonight? And she's like, yeah, it's in the basement. So I go down in the basement and the room is filled with men who work in the building. The elevator guy, the guy who's washing the floors, the guy who's cooking the meals, you know, they're all of these men live in a sober house up in Harlem, and they're trying to stay sober, and this is their job. And so there's a meeting down in the basement. None of them know anything about AA. And I don't know anyone in Boston and New York, nobody. And so what I got to do was help them. You know, that's all I knew. Like, you guys taught me to stop worrying about if life shows up for me, but can I show up for life? What do I have to give? Like, this is a giving program, not a getting program, right? It's through self-forgetting. And that's over and over the principles that you guys taught me, is that here we make spiritual alchemy. That if I'm willing to put in the work, right, that when life gives me lemons, that my job is to squeeze them, and God's got the big bag of sugar, and that he's going to make it good no matter what, as long as I am willing to suit up and show up and keep squeezing them and keep myself in the path of grace. That's what I was taught. And, you know, I got to do the inventory on that relationship with my sister and her husband, and I got to stand up and be a bridesmaid for them at their wedding. And you know what? They really are a better match than I ever would have been. And the truth is, I never would have been able to appreciate my wonderful husband if that whole thing hadn't blown up in my face. That's the honest truth, you know. And I've seen over and over again how life has given me the opportunity, thank you, to, you know, see things differently. The old timers always said that, you know, the other meaning for AA was attitude adjustment, that everything came down to, it's not my problem. It's my problem with my problem. That if I do a real third step, that what that means is that, you know, it's not my life anymore. I don't get a say in who I marry. I don't get a say in where I live. The only place I ever wanted to not live is in Boston, Massachusetts. And I have been here now for 19 years. And all I can tell you is that, you know, when I did that third step with my sponsor all those years ago, I was so afraid that, you know, it's like, what if God wants me to go be a missionary in Africa? And she said, honey, then you're going to love it. Then you're going to love it. And, you know, that's my experience, is that God has made this a beautiful life, a beautiful life. You know, I have two great kids. Both of them were born. They had a lot of medical problems when they were born, a lot. And, you know, I lived by speaker tapes back then. You know, I couldn't take them to meetings because they were really sick, you know, and AA showed up for me in ways I can't even begin to imagine, you know, begin to tell you that over the years, the main thing that I saw happen, God doing over and over and over again, was whenever I wasn't okay, God sent me somebody that was really in need. That my job was self-forgetting. You know, you guys helped me recalibrate my heart over and over again, right? That's my sponsees have saved my life. They've saved my life. They helped me get out of self. They helped me remember what is really important, that there are no strings attached anymore. Hardest thing I ever did was give God my kids. It is the hardest thing in the world to know that your child may not be okay. And that doesn't make the world a bad place. It doesn't make the world a bad place. You know, I've gone through back surgeries, multiple back surgeries, hysterectomy. They just took a bunch of bones out of my head, you know, for the beginning of this COVID thing. You know, my son couldn't walk or talk, you know, and today you would never know. There have been miracles all around my life. And it's not about everything working out, because when I did this stuff, I didn't know it was going to work out. I had no idea anything was ever going to work out. You know, and I remember somebody saying to me once, you know, because I also had a really bad eating disorder. And this woman said to me, she said, I would be able to do this too if I knew that I was going to end up like you. And I thought, you know what, that's the opposite of what it is. You know, when my sponsor looked at me and she said, honey, are you willing to wear the muumuu? I had to say yes. You know, I didn't know what it's going to look like. I didn't know that my kids were going to be okay. I didn't know any of this was going to be okay. But I was willing for the first time ever, because of you, to say, I don't know what's best for me. I believe the steps were designed to take us from belief to trust. I want to free fall into God today. I want to trust God. Do I always? No. You can tell. I can tell exactly how far I am from that third step decision by how many opinions I have. When I think I know what the way the world should be, that's the distance between me and God. You know, the truth is that right here, right now, everything is okay. Welcoming it, it's hard. It's really hard. You know, it would be really easy for me to make a case for still being a victim. You know, I was identified with that victim mentality when I got to you. And the truth is that I am not a victim anymore, that I get this incredible life, that every single one of those things has been converted. You know, it says in the family afterwards that we absolutely insist on enjoying our life, that my job, you know, princess of the temper tantrums, my job is to take that character defect of giving a really good temper tantrum and to absolutely kick and scream and to not let anything come between me and enjoying my life, that I am absolutely sure God wants me happy, joyous, and free. And when I decided to believe in that God, to keep mindful that 10th step, turn back to this one, this is the God I choose to believe in. I choose to believe in the God that wants me happy, joyous, and free. When I do that, then I know that the shortcut to my heart's desire is to align my will with God's. And then I really can. I can free fall into God. And I just want to thank each and every one of you for allowing me to be with you this evening. And thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Arisa.
Commitments available at this time. We celebrate his freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you're a regular attender of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P.
Hi, everybody. Make sure you don't forget your picture. Thank you for letting me be of service. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Ann. You can email her at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by 7:15 p.m. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to be recognized. We have several birthdays tonight. This week, we have asked George S. to sing Happy Birthday to our celebrants.
Hi, everybody. I'm George, alcoholic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Thank you, George. Okay, our birthdays for the week of July 29th. Simone T for 2 years, sponsored by Patty C. Happy birthday. Christopher H with 10 years. Dave W is his sponsor. Happy birthday, Christopher. Bree S with 14 years, sponsored by Lulu L. Happy birthday, Bree. Ryan F, 19 years, sponsored by Tim K. Happy birthday, Ryan. Oxtilla N, with 21 years, sponsored by Quincy W. Happy birthday. Ashok D, with 24 years, sponsored by Clancy I. Happy birthday, Ashok. Bill K with 24 years, sponsored by Thomas S. Happy birthday, Bill. Lydia W with 25 years, sponsored by Rhonda D. Happy birthday, Lydia. Stephen W with 34 years, former secretary, sponsored by Clancy I. Happy birthday, Steve. Catherine B, 36 years, sponsored by Rita S. Happy birthday, Catherine. That is a 10 birthdays, total of 209 years, with an average of 20.9 years. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H., at treasure@pacificgroupla.org. Okay. Hello, Betty. Also, I'd like to remind you that all of these email addresses are announced at about approximately 7:15 every Wednesday night prior to the meeting. So feel free to get those email addresses prior to the meeting during the announcements. Special announcements.